And welcome to this month's episode of the Authors Between the Covers show on the Incandescent Radio Network and incandescent.tv. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, creator of the Incandescent PR and Publishing Company and the proud host of this show. I cannot tell you how excited I am to introduce you to our guest, great American novelist Gregory Maguire. Hello, Gregory.
Hello, Hope. How are you?
Great. Y'all may know him as the author of Wicked, Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, Hidden Sea, the Nutcracker's Backstory, which I had the privilege of interviewing him for Costco's magazine in 2017, and he's written dozens of other best-selling novels for adults and children, most of which, or all of which, are inspired by classic children's stories, so we'll get more into that. Gregory first published his first novel, The Lightning Time, back in 1978. Wicked published in 1995 and was adapted into a Broadway musical in 2003. And coming this fall, 2024, it will be a major motion picture. So we can't wait to hear all about it. Welcome, Gregory, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. It's great to see you, Hope. And it certainly has been a wild ride on a broom I didn't realize I was hailing when I set out almost 50 years ago.
Wow, that is just so incredible. And your life is so incredible. And we'll get into some of the personal stuff after we start talking about the book. So this article is actually for the October issue of the Costco Connection. And several of your books will be available at Costco this fall, mostly from the Wicked series. So everyone who needs a great holiday gift, run out to Costco and buy these books. So, all right, take us back to the beginning. Let's talk about Wicked. What drew you to The Wizard of Oz as a source of inspiration?
I had played in the backyard little theatrical games based on The Wizard of Oz from the time I was in second or third grade. And I remember this quite precisely because we were not a very prosperous family and the kids had to play in the backyard so they didn't get run over on the busy street. And I was the boss kid. Did you ever realize, Hope, that in a large family, there's always one kid who makes all the plans and decides what everybody else is going to do? That's the boss kid. And I was the boss kid in our family. I had six brothers and sisters. Many families in the neighborhood were just as big or bigger. And so I would gather my little squadron together and decide what we were doing that day. Whenever The Wizard of Oz had been aired the night before, it was fresh in the mind of every child, so I had a purpose-built cast ready to go, and I would assign parts, and we would sort of improvise our way through the story that we had just had refreshed in our minds the night before. In a way, I think at the age of 7 or 8, I was beginning to play with found materials, which is this story that it seemed like everybody knew, just like everybody knew Santa Claus, and everybody knew the Tooth Fairy, and most people I knew the Gospels too. It just was one of those stories that seemed like you came born knowing it. That's how it felt. And so everybody played along with me, but I would then shake it up a little bit. And I would say, okay, people, we're going to do this again. We're going to run through again. We're going to mix it up a little bit. We're going to do some, you know, cross-gender casting, and we can try out different parts. And also this time, why don't you over there in the corner, you didn't do much the first time through. Why don't you be Captain Hook? And so some of the kids would say, but Gregory, Captain Hook isn't in this story. And I'd say, excuse me, it's my story. If I say Captain Hook is in this version, he is. And he's going to come in and he's going to get married to the Wicked Witch of the West. And they're going to have twins. And they'll be called Little Hookums and Little Snookums. And so once you introduce a foreign agent into the yeast, it can't rise in the same way. It has to do something different. And I think I sort of understood that that's how stories were made. You take what you know and you put something foreign and alien into it and then see what happens, see what you get. So I think I became a writer on the basis of loving to play with the found material of story.
That is so amazing and fascinating how a writer's mind develops, right? So you've always felt like you were a storyteller and words were your medium. So tell us about this history of Wicked. So you wanted to do this, you wanted to write this book. Take it from
Well,
there.
that came, of course, about 20 years later, or even more, 25 maybe. I forget. I'm not very good at math. But I was living in London in the early 1990s, so a little over 30 years ago, and there was a terrible murder in London of a small boy who had wandered away from his mother's apron strings, and by the end of the day was found killed on a railroad bed. There was a manhunt in that part of Liverpool, I think it was, or Manchester. And then there was a boy hunt because security cameras had spotted schoolboys walking along a public pedestrian mall with this little lost kid in between them. And once the boys were identified, there began to be a loud conversation all throughout England about who these boys were and how they could wake up in the morning, get dressed for school, and become murderers by the end of the day. This was a question that it's hard to answer even now after 30 years, but it's a question I think it's important to ask because we have to know ourselves whether we could suddenly crack and do something that we would consider criminal or immoral or sinful even. So everybody started talking about where these boys came from and how they could be like this. And I began thinking about it too. And I really started asking myself the question, what are the roots of evil? Where does it come from? Were these boys always terrible? Or did they get kind of corrupted by life? They were not in a good situation, but you don't have to be poor to be, to do bad things, as we all know. Money doesn't have that much to do with it. But so in asking that question, I thought I can't ask it about these boys. I'm not a journalist. I'm not going to go interview them. I have to ask it imaginatively, which is what I've always done. And I decided to write a story about somebody who was recognized as being evil. And I thought, well, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? The Wicked Witch of the West. Children's books are what I know best. And the minute I thought of her, I thought, oh, I've had a vision through my whole Catholic boyhood. I thought the Virgin Mary would come out of the clouds one day, but instead it's not the Virgin Mary. Look, the clouds are parting. It's Margaret Hamilton, and she's coming down on a cloud, and she's saying, I'll get you and your little dog. And I thought, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, I've had a vision. I've had a vision. Everybody knows who the Wicked Witch of the West is. Nobody knows how she got that way. Nobody cares what happens to her. And everybody's glad when she dies. That's ripe material. So I really took The Wizard of Oz because it was hanging around on the, in the pantry. I didn't set out just because I love the story. I set out to write about evil. And in so doing, Hope, I sort of discovered I don't really know very much about it. And I have to let this character be herself in order to instruct me both what she's like and what it is that we who find ourselves adjacent to dubious people, what it is that we do with that information, and do we make it worse by stereotyping, by scapegoating? Are we partly responsible? So those were the questions I had in my head.
Amazing. So how did you decide to answer this? Like, tell us more about the writer process and how it evolved.
Well, I was very, without going too much into the psychodrama of it, because my mother had died in childbirth when I was born, I had a kind of a suspicion, superstition, I think is actually the word that I mean, that I would never get to be 39 years old. I would never be able to be older than she was, because how can you ever get older than your mother? I mean, your mother's supposed to be older than you are, right? And until I was the very end of my 38th year, I was writing children's books. But on the day I turned 39, I said to myself, if you are 1 year older than your mother ever got to be, because she died at 38, then that's proof you're a grown up. That's proof you can take on grown up material, because you're older than your mother. So I began to write Wicked that day, the first day of my 39th year. I was in the Lake District in England. And I started walking around. I was actually on Beatrix, near Beatrix Potter's farm in the Lake District. And I started remembering what I could think of about The Wizard of Oz, both the book and the movie. And I sort of remembered this scene. I don't even know if it's actually in the movie, but I sort of remember at one point Margaret Hamilton whirling around and pointing to Billy Burke and saying, "I might have known you'd be behind this, Glinda." Now, I don't actually know if that line is actually in the movie, but that's what I heard in my head. And I thought, oh my gosh, these ladies know each other. I mean, when the Wicked Witch shows up in Munchkinland, nobody says, "Oh, Wicked Witch, allow me to present, Glinda, the Good Witch of the North." They clearly know each other. They recognize each other. They have a history. I wonder if they went to school together. And at that, I fell off my ankles laughing on the grass of the Lake District in Northern England because I thought that is too wonderful. Of course they went to school together and they had to be roommates. And that's where all this begins. So in a way, that's where the story began too.
How fascinating. I love how writers can just make themselves laugh. That's so
I do it a lot, but I laugh a lot anyway, so.
cool. So Wicked became a Broadway musical. How did that evolve?
After the book was published, it got very good notices, and it sold very well, and it was optioned by Hollywood. The calls from Hollywood started coming in the morning after a Sunday front page book review over the fold praising item in the LA Times. Next Monday morning, my agents started getting calls. I had to hire a Hollywood agent like immediately, and I fielded offers for about a year, and eventually Universal Studios and Demi Moore gave me an option, or I took the option that they proposed, and it was in development hell, I think they call that. That's in quotes. So if you're worried about my swearing, that's in quotes. That's the term of art in the industry. It was in development hell for about 3 years. I saw some of the scripts. I didn't really admire them. It was making the story more for middle schoolers or even younger. And there was a lot of scatological humor, a lot of pratfalls. It was taking the seriousness out of my story. But I had three adopted kids that I needed to feed. So I was just going to take the money and bow my head and try to get out the back door, before anybody was looking. And then Stephen Schwartz, the composer, eventually of Wicked, the play, heard about the book from the folk singer Holly Near. And Holly said, "I'm reading this great book." And Stephen said, "Oh, sounds like my return to Broadway." And he went to Hollywood and found out who owned the rights. And he presented himself at Universal Studios to the door of Mark Platt. And he went in and he said, "I've been keeping my ear to the keyholes. And everybody says you can't get a good script for the story. And I know why." And Mark said, "Why?" And Stephen said, "Ever since 1938, everybody knows that everyone in Oz can sing, and they should sing this story before you make it into a movie. I will make it into a play, and it will build its own audience. And then by the time you get around to making it into a movie, it will already be a phenomenon." Well, that's exactly what happened. But I'll tell you what, Hope. It happened by a factor of about 20 times more than anybody anticipated. It's now in its, I think, 22nd year on Broadway, the play. It's the fourth longest running play in Broadway history. And it has been seen by millions and millions of people around the world. And the movie, which is going to, be released in two parts, one part this fall and part two next fall, is one of the most lavish productions I've ever seen. I've heard tell that the budget for the two movies was about $400 million. And you know what? It looks like it. It is so beautiful. I haven't seen the whole thing. I've only seen what everybody else has seen on YouTube, clips. But it's dazzling. And I did go and visit the set and saw it being filmed too. So that's how it became a musical. And the musical surprised everyone by, I mean, people thought it was going to do okay, But it did more than okay. It actually broke box office records in almost every theater it played in for the first 10 years.
That is so as a writer, it's all in your head, and now it's out in front of millions and millions of people in multiple versions. Tell us about
Yeah.
that feels.
One would think that that would be a condition for the requirement of a whole lot of therapy because a writer lives in a very private space. I mean, if you're looking at my image and not just listening to me on the radio or on your device, you'll see I have a study and it's a nice built, it's a nice room, it's a nice building, it's a nicely appointed, and I'm very happy here. But I spend 99% of my working life here in this room alone. When something escapes out the door or out the window and it goes into the world, when it's a book, I will expect to get anywhere from no to may from none to maybe, 200 letters of appreciation. Very often it's none, like, oh, well, that one didn't go anywhere. Or if people liked it, they didn't feel like writing to me about it. But when something enters into the entertainment industry, it's a whole different kettle of fish. And if you are, as I am, a fairly shy person and a person who's happy to live in my own mind rather than on the red carpets of Hollywood, then that much attention could be crushing. It is very lucky, therefore, hope, that just about the time that Wicked was starting to really hit the stratosphere, my three adopted children were, going into grade school. And the needs of children in my universe are always more important than anything else. So I didn't adopt children so they could help me with my own mental health. But in fact, their needs took over. And anything else that happened, oh, I was invited to go to Australia for the opening of Wicked. I was invited to go some other place. I said to Japan when it opened in Japan, to Korea, I turned them all down. Said no, I'm on lunch duty that week. I'm supposed to supervise the kids bringing in money for milk. I'm not going to Japan, to Tokyo, to swan around like some jerk. I've got a job to do here, and that's how I wanted it. So my kids, I think, helped me keep my feet on the ground. So I hope that answers your question. How
No,
did it feel?
absolutely.
It felt weird, but I felt protected. I felt protected by real life.
That is so beautiful. So you are married to American painter Andy Newman. It was one of the first same-sex marriages
That's
performed
right.
in the state of Massachusetts, and we are talking to you from your studio home there in Massachusetts. And so tell us about that experience and also about your three kids.
Well, like some families in this country and around the world, we had our kids before we got married because we weren't allowed to get married. It wasn't yet legal. We as the decades have gone on, and we've been married now for 20 years, 20 years ago last month, as the decades have gone on, we end up being among in the first cohort of same-sex marriages in the history of this nation. We were in the first 4.5 weeks. We didn't want to do it the first day or the first week because I didn't want public attention on it. Again, to protect the kids, I didn't want cameras there recording it and making it a news item. We decided to wait for the first blush, the first month to go by. And then when everybody had read enough stories about it and wanted to move on to something else, then we thought, now we can sneak in under the radar and have a ceremony that's suitable for our family and for us. The kids were about 6 and 4 and 3, and they walked us, they gave us away at the ceremony in our backyard, where there were about 120 people in attendance. And then they took us back as soon as the service was over. And the kids are from overseas. The both boys are from Cambodia, and their sister, our daughter, is from Guatemala. So they were raised in a peculiar household. But you know what, Hope? I always say, I think that our household was, I suppose it was peculiar that they had two dads instead of a dad and a mom, or one mom, or one dad, or two moms. I mean, I concur. I admit that that was unusual. But I think what was even more unusual in their childhoods was that they had two parents who were artists. So neither of us had a 9-to-5 job. Neither of us were getting in the car and rushing off to be someplace else. That meant both of us walked them down the driveway to the school bus every morning. And every afternoon when the school bus came to deliver them, both of us were waiting there to take them in to supervise their unpacking their knapsacks and cleaning their lunchboxes and starting on their homework. So it wasn't just one of us. It didn't fall on only one set of shoulders. And I think adopted children can be insecure, but I think we were able to give them a brace of dads, if you will, to help them feel secure because of the way that we worked, because we were both self-employed.
And so what are they all doing now?
Well, they're in various occupations. They're all through, those who went to college are through college and employed. One is in L.A. One is in Augusta, Georgia, in the Army, just finishing up a course in cybersecurity. And the third one is living at home and working in a bakery. So congenial, and we get together often, and we are still very intact as a family. I know some families that break up. I mean, you don't have to be an adopted child to want to get away from your family. It happens to a lot of us. But we're very happy so far, as the kids are, solidly in the middle of their 20s, that they actually feel more committed to us and more attached to each other than they even did in their teens. So I'm feeling, of course, there are bumps ahead. Nobody's flight path is particularly smooth in this life, but they have each other and they have us still. And so that makes me very happy.
That is so beautiful. You're amazing. So, all right, now back to the books and what people can go buy at Costco. So this Wicked series, there's a whole bunch of stories. Tell us about the spectrum of what you've created.
Well, yes. Now, you would think that in a book called Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, a book in which, as you might know, the witch gets splashed by a bucket of water on the second to last page. And if she survives, nobody knows about it. Nothing else is said about what happened to her when she disappeared. Well, how can you write a sequel to a book in which the main character is gone? And I struggled with that for a little bit. I didn't really want to write a sequel. About 9 years after the book had come out, and the play had opened and was, doing good box office, we had the first Gulf War. No, it was actually the lead up to the second Gulf War, I guess. And there were those photographs that came out of Abu Ghraib. I don't know if you remember, where political prisoners and terrorists, if they were terrorists, were being tortured. And there was one particular photograph of a man with a hood on his head and electrodes hooked up to his fingers. It was one of the photographs of our times, I'm afraid, like that small child burning of napalm in the Vietnam War, just one of these photographs that you can't forget when you see. And so I that photograph tore my heart out of my chest. That's just not a way to treat a human being, even a bad human being, even if that person was a terrorist and had killed someone. There are laws against that kind of treatment of political prisoners, and I couldn't bear it. So in order not to go insane, because I still had a job of raising my family and keeping my own mental health intact, I decided to go back to Oz, because in Oz I can safely find myself in somewhat treacherous territory and try to pull myself through it and try to pull characters through it. And I remembered that in Wicked, not so much on the play, probably not in the movie, the script of which I haven't seen, the witch and Fiero have an illegitimate child. And by the end of Wicked, the novel, he's 14 years old and he's hanging out in the castle with his mother. And then she disappears thanks to the bucket of water. What happens to him? Suddenly, he's about the age of my kids. And I started caring more about his situation. And so I wrote the book called Son of a Witch, which was about what happened to him when his mother disappeared. Where did he go? How did he make it through? And he wasn't really sure that she was his mother because she wouldn't admit to it. She wouldn't admit ever to having had a child. She wasn't sure. I suppose this can happen if you're a witch. It doesn't happen to most women, but she wasn't really sure if she'd ever given birth. And so the book, Son of a Witch, is about his journey from 14 to about 24, in which he grows up and actually finds proof of his provenance, proof of his bloodlines, if you will, by the end of that book. And then, so once I'd gotten back, once I'd kind of uncorked that vintage again and poured myself a drink, then it was kind of intoxicating. And I went back for two other books. A Lion Among Men is about the cowardly lion, where he came from and what happened to him even after the end of Son of a Witch. And then Out of Oz is about the return of Dorothy to Oz. She's about 6 years older. She's now, instead of being 10 years old the way she was in the original novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, published in 1900, she's now 16. She's more like Judy Garland when Judy Garland played a 10-year-old. And I have fun with that too. And L. Frank Baum, the author of The Original Wizard of Oz, did bring Dorothy back to Oz. So I was just playing on sort of his invention. Dorothy comes back to Oz, and there's been a political rethinking about the witch. She's been rehabilitated while Dorothy was gone and over the 30 years intervening, Oz years, that is. And Dorothy's put on trial for her murder. So that's what Out of Oz is about.
Oh, it's such an imagination. It's fantastic. Living inside your brain must be real fun. So tell us, what is next for you?
Well, after I wrote those Out of Oz, I named Out of Oz, which is available at Costco, along with the other three books I've mentioned. After I wrote Out of Oz, I thought, now I'm really done. I even named it Out of Oz, as if like I'm out of gin, I'm out of spaghetti sauce, I'm out of money for this week. We'll have to wait till next week. I was trying to give myself a kind of instruction. You have finished this cycle. You're done. The title even says it. But then, Hope, same thing happened as with Son of a Witch. My kids kept growing up, and COVID began to happen. And my youngest daughter, who had just gone away to college, had about 6 months at college before college dorms closed, and she had to come home. So suddenly, she is now just a little bit older than the age Dorothy was at the end of Out of Oz, and then the other character, Lear's daughter, whose name is Rain. And I had ended Out of Oz with Rain having found a twig from her grandmother's broom and taught herself to fly on it and flown actually beyond the country limits of Oz, out over an ocean that few even knew about. Oz is not as landlocked as everybody thought. It's just that beyond the high mountains, there actually was an ocean. It was like people, like European travelers going across Central America and finding the Pacific and like the penny dropping. Dong! Oh my gosh, this isn't even India. This is someplace else. There's another ocean over there. So Rain found the ocean, and I finished Out of Oz with her flying away from Oz, getting out of Oz herself, literally on her grandmother's broom, so to speak. But 10 years later, COVID happens. My daughter's home, huddled underneath her Kermit the Froggy blankie, trying to do freshman college courses from a fetal position in her bed on her Zoom. And I think to myself, I can't leave that poor child out flying over the ocean. She's as I can't rescue her. The job of an artist, the job of an author, even the job of a parent, I think, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, the job is not to rescue your children. or your protagonists. The job is to follow them. Make sure that they know they're seen. Make sure that they know they're in your radar. You will do what you can. You will shout advice. You can't necessarily throw out the safety net, but you can make sure they're not alone. That's maybe the main thing. Maybe that's the main definition of parenting, to make sure that somebody else is not alone. So I couldn't leave Rain alone out over the ocean anymore. I'd left her hovering there for 10 years. So I went back and I wrote three more books about her adventures, which are called Another Day. They're a different series. They're not The Wicked Years. It's called Another Day. And I finished it up just about as COVID was finishing. And I thought, phew, okay, I've got her back safely. Her feet are on the ground. Now I'm going to walk away. And so this is like the third time in a row I've said I'm walking away from this material. Then something else happened. Last one. Next year, next March, just about 7 months from now, I have one more book. It will be my eighth book set in my Oz, if you will. And it's called Elfie. And it is the childhood of Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, between the ages of 2 and 16. So when I originally wrote Wicked, it was 500 pages of manuscript. And my editor said, we're going to buy this. We're going to pay you nicely for it, but you have to lose 80 pages. And I lost 80 pages. And in those 80 pages, there were about three little tiny episodes of things that happened to her when she was 4 and when she was 12 that had to hit the cutting room floor. Now, Hope, Wicked has become this kind of enterprise. It's like intellectual property. It has escaped this room. It has burst through those windows, and I'm never going to see it again. It belongs to the world now. I mean, copyright belongs to me, but it's in everybody else's mind. And it's probably going to survive me. I'm going to be dead, but people are going to remember Fiero and Madame Morrible and Dr. Dillamond and other characters I invented, as well as the characters I played with. And I realized sooner or later, somebody's going to say, hey, let's do a young Elphaba and young Glinda series, you know, like young Bugs Bunny and, you know, young Sherlock Holmes. You know, somebody's going to do that. And I'm not going to be around to say no. So I thought, if somebody's going to say what her childhood was like, I think it should be me. People can deviate from it the way they've deviated from everything else. But I want to be the first one to put my hoof print in that particular sand. So that will be, I'm saying this to you now, Hope, that will be my eighth and final book derived from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz many, many generations later. But who knows? I'm not promising anything.
I love that. The world loves that. So if you could meet Baum, what would you say to him? You could have dinner with the originator.
Oh, gosh. I would say to him, honey, you ain't got no idea what's uncorked. And your characters have become part of the foundational myth of our entire nation. I think stories about George Washington and the cherry tree, Abraham Lincoln walking 5 miles to deliver a nickel to somebody who had been underpaid and making change. I think Washington crossing the Delaware and the soldiers on Iwo Jima and Thoreau living on Walden and writing about the natural world. There are some things that are natural, national myths that belong to all of us and make us recognize what it is to be American. And I would tell Baum, Dorothy is part of our national psyche now. She is one of us, and she defines us and her adventures. She goes to this magic land, but she actually performs what is required of her, mostly without the agency of magic. She performs well because she arrives with courage and with fortitude and with Midwestern common sense and with an open heart. And so too do we hope as Americans to retain all those attributes, make our nation better in the years to come than it has been.
Wow. Amazing. We could talk to you forever. Get you to run for president. Well, thank you, best-selling author Gregory Maguire, author of Wicked and so many, and 8 stories that focus around that magical cyclone.
Yeah, that magical cyclone keeps spinning. I keep trying to get off at the next stop, but then it sweeps me back up again.
Well, we can't thank you enough, sir. So this article will appear in the October issue of the Costco Connection, and it will be on the Incandescent Radio Network and incandescent.tv coming this fall when the film comes out in November. So thank you again for your time, sir. Appreciate you. Don't go yet, but
thank
we're going
you, Hope.
To say goodbye to our audience. Thank you all. Take care and go get that book at Costco.
Bye-bye.